So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is November 5th, 2014. And I want to talk about meditation. And I want to talk about it in a certain kind of way and see what you make of it. So you may know that in Buddhism, there are said to be three pillars of practice. Or another way to put it is three great means to the end of awakening. What are those three pillars of practice? In Pali, the language of early Buddhism, they're described as sila, samadhi, and panya. True Sanskrit scholars might pronounce those in other ways, so be it. What that means basically, sila, virtue, restraint, morality, don't be evil, okay? Samadhi, that's the pillar of concentration, of meditation, including cultivating the capacity to enter into fairly deep, somewhat non-ordinary, if not really non-ordinary, states of consciousness, because that's a means to an end of purifying the body, mind, and sharpening insight so it can acquire a kind of laser-like focus into the nature of our own experience. And then the third pillar is wisdom, panya, wisdom, insight, understanding, wise view, perspective. So you can see that of those three pillars, one of the three is really zeroed in on meditation. And in fact, in order to truly be virtuous, to be restrained and to practice sila, we need to really cultivate present moment awareness, in part through meditation, so that we can recognize the causes of our actions and their consequences, their effects, and become more virtuous as a result. Also, to find wisdom. The primary pathway, certainly in Buddhism, for the acquisition of wisdom, a primary pathway is through meditation, through really, really recognizing in a way that just sinks into your bones that experiences are streaming along, and if you hold on to them, you suffer and create suffering for other people as well. So I want to talk about that samadhi pillar in a particular kind of way. So what is meditation? It's all the rage. I was walking through the airport and on my way to, of all places, NASA. That's where I gave a talk in a workshop there, and I just got back. Quite something. And they're interested in meditation. They're interested in mindfulness, neurodharma. What is that stuff? Right. And so on the way through the airport, I saw that the cover of Scientific American, this month's issue, I guess, is The Science of Meditation. And you know, recently, of course, Time Magazine had that cover, The Mindfulness Revolution. What is meditation? So I want to talk about, in a sense, three kinds of meditation. The first kind, for me, is basically letting the sediments settle in the pool of the mind. We sit, we try to find some kind of basic presence. Maybe we're not in any kind of white light moment, but we're chilling out. You know, and this busy mind of ours, which in ways that are abnormal departures from the evolutionary template for how much stimulation the human brain is really designed to assimilate on a, you know, minute-by-minute basis. Our minds are so chock full of planning and worrying and, you know, wondering and, you know, could I do this? What about that? And what's going to happen now that the Republicans are in charge of the Senate? Or, yeah, like that. You know, and what's my kid? My kid's in his 20s, and he's like wondering if what his way in life is. Or, you know, and where's the milk? Is there any milk in the fridge? You know, like, it's all that. It's just great to let it settle out, isn't it? Just let it settle out. I think that's an okay kind of meditation. Sort of like relaxing, presence, the mind wanders, come back. Things kind of settle out. That's worth doing. You know, if that's a lot of what's available some morning when you're meditating, that's still a good thing to do. It's good. The second type of meditation is one in which we're really trying to cultivate one particular thing. We might be trying to cultivate loving kindness or compassion, or maybe we're trying to cultivate concentration so we can really stay present moment after moment after moment with a mind that tends to wander. Or maybe we're cultivating insight. We're trying to really track what happens after there is the hedonic tone or feeling tone of experience as pleasant or unpleasant, right? So my body's achy. That's unpleasant, let's say. My nose is stuffed. Maybe that feels unpleasant. What happens then? Do I get angry at my body? Do I get angry at myself? Do I get angry at United Airlines for allowing other people to be on my flight who have germs? The audacity, you know? We cultivate insight into what happens after the sense of something as unpleasant or pleasant or heartfelt or neutral. That would be an example as well. So that to me is a second kind of meditation. And by the way, I'm not saying that my list of three is exhaustive or it's the only one, but I've been meditating since 1974 and in a lot of different settings with a lot of different people. And I see it boiling down to more or less one of these three things, or some combination of the above. Okay? Do people, you tracking what I'm saying? You know what I'm talking about when I talk about just relaxing, trying to be present, coming back the first way. The mind gradually settles, and things clarify. It's good, okay? You also know what I'm talking about, where we're trying to develop something, which means changing our brain in some way. Trying to develop something. Here's a third one. The third way of meditating, which can be supported by the first two and intertwines with them, for me is essentially about being that which we aspire to develop. Which, in other words, using this time that we meditate as a kind of important and protected time in which we try to open into and drop into or allow or evoke, the qualities of an awakened being as much as we can. We're in this tradition, not to push it on anyone, just naming it, a way that shows up for me is I try to imagine what in the world is the nature of the brain of a Buddha, or the mind of a Buddha. Or you could say, if you're theistically inclined, opening into some sense of the divine and abiding as that. That's a traditional path, for example. In Hinduism, it's summarized with, I believe, the Sanskrit formula, tat pham asi, thou art that. Or as Michael said in Heinlein's masterpiece, stranger in a strange land, you are God. That's a sci-fi reference for those of you. You got that. Good. Some of us are old enough. Anyway, so my point is, and so then that's a really far out way to meditate. In a sense, we're cultivating. We're taking the fruit as the path. We're trying to, without being deluded about where we actually are, gradually open into or encourage, receive, however we want to think about it, or allow the opening of the flower of the mind out into that. So what are the qualities of, I'll say, Buddha mind that we can open into and cultivate in our meditation? And because neurons that fire together wire together, as we clock more minutes or seconds, more moments in that which we aspire to, right? It becomes more stabilized. We become increasingly sort of permeable to it, rising through us, working through us. We come back to it more rapidly. It gets more stabilized for us. It's a beautiful form of practice, I think, right? What are you doing when you meditate? Well, I'm trying to get as close as I can to the Buddha stream, and then engage that process without grasping, right? So what are the qualities of that which we aspire to, of the Buddha stream? And I want to name four, and the fourth is out in the deep end of the pool, okay? So what do we do when we meditate? Well, one thing we do is we cultivate a mind of no craving. Right? Because clearly one of the attributes, think of the defining attributes, constituting attributes of the Buddha mind, as we understand it. It's a mind that in the Third Noble Truth has gone beyond craving. There's been a cessation. So minimally when we sit there, right, we cultivate or we open to a letting go of resisting anything at all. That's a really fundamental form of craving. We stop pushing away our feelings, we stop pushing away sounds. You know, you could just feel that whole little moment when that young woman was talking loudly and enthusiastically, you know, and you could just, you know, it'd be so easy to go, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's a kind of craving. That's a resisting, right? Or maybe something arises. We think about some interesting way of spending our time or some little plan for lunch with a friend tomorrow. And, you know, we could get all into it. But instead of doing that, we just let it go. We let it go. And we explore more and more. What is it like to be here? Just kind of hanging. Being. Not working. Just being. Without, and ever more subtly letting go of grasping or resisting or kind of, I call it, you know, I think clinging in terms of relationships, twirling in terms of relationships. And the more we do that, you know, neurons that fire together, wire together, the more we stabilize in our releasing grosser and grosser forms of craving, broadly defined. A second attribute of Buddha mind, as I understand it, is warm-heartedness, lovingness, loving-kindness. You know, you can just feel it. We could be here all kind of dry, letting go, letting go, letting go. But that's not, you know, that doesn't really work very well. And who'd want to be that? Like robo-dharma, you know? You don't want to do that. So, right? So you find a warm-heartedness. And, you know, neurologically, warm-heartedness helps calm us down so we can be more stable and also tends to steady the mind because it has positive emotional qualities to it that are rewarding. And also, it's just good practice anyway. And besides, you know, that too is our sense of that which we want to open into and allow ourselves to be increasingly, right? Warm-heartedness, lovingness, compassion shows up in lots of ways, including a kind of friendliness toward ourselves, you know, that has an emotionally positive quality, right? Third attribute, I think of a mind of a Buddha that we find ourselves opening into, it becomes how we meditate, is less and less sense of self. As soon as we, you know, we be aware, because we're present, of taking things personally, right? Or, you know, that kind of commentary inside, you can feel it. It's like this congealing of a doer, right, in the mind. This presumption of an entity in the mind, and you can gradually let it go. There's an ongoingness of experiencing that is familiar to a particular body and a particular perspective, but there's less and less sense of I. So we engage that as a practice. We feel the edge of it, and then we see if we can let go one bit more. And then we feel the remaining kind of contracting or presuming of an I, and we let that go as well. And more, we're just kind of hanging as experience. There is experience, there is mind, right? But less and less, there's a sense of an I in there. Or if the sense of I arises a little bit as a kind of perspective on what's happening, it too tends to dissipate as well in the streaming of mind, which is there. There is mind, right? But there is less and less sense of a me, an I, looking at it, commenting on it, making decisions about it. Right? Get a feeling for that? Yeah. Kind of territory. It's a little kind of, but yeah. And I'm thinking there of the line from the third Zen patriarch in his this fantastic little summary that starts out, "The great way is easy for one who has no preferences," right? In there, there's an amazing line where he says, "Enlightenment is no anxiety about imperfection." Like, what? And there, it's like not having a one who gets anxious about imperfection. Anyway. So, okay so far?
Yeah.
Rick Hansen, Space Cadet. Fourth, right? This is where it gets really interesting. Because if you work backwards, it's kind of reverse engineering, right? People who are saints or sages, Buddha, let's say, different traditions even. It's interesting when they talk about their own experience. We're like, what's it like? What's it like to be you, right? And my perception of that is that across different traditions, there's a very strong sense of oneness. You know the joke about the Dalai Lama and the hot dog vendor? He said, "Make me one with everything," right? It's that oneness. They talk about that. There's like a oneness, a transparency, you know? I don't know if you heard that old joke. You finally got it, right? So it's a real old chestnut, as they say, but it's kind of cool. So how do we do that? How do we have that sense of oneness, right? People who describe Satori or Kensho experiences, or, you know, they talk about just oneness, right? What's that? What's going on with that? And so I'm going to try to talk about it a little bit. And it's, you know, it's sometimes hard to talk about. A way that works for me to talk about it and experience it as kind of a map is, for one, opening out into oneness with mind, experience, just as it is, you know, here and now. Just like being the whole, opening into the whole of your experience, undivided. Make sense? You know, that which, and you can feel most of the time we're divided from our own experience. We're partitioning it, and we're over here looking at it over there, right? Or then there's this third voice popping up that's commenting on the fact that we can't go into oneness, you know? What's up with that? And what I'm talking about is, what is it like, especially in meditation, where we more and more just present moment awareness, just being here, not making sense of things, not trying to make things connect with each other, just letting that whole fizzing process, like, run, you know? And increasingly there's less sense of partition inside it. You're more opened out into your own experience. Right? Okay. And then, second step, so if you think about trying to do this, that's like a good first step. That's no small first step. That sense will typically last briefly in the beginning, because fairly, as soon as it's happening, your mind will comment on it, and then you're partitioned again, right? And then you go, okay, it's kind of letting go some more. What really supports that is letting go, relaxing, okay? Opening out, undivided, allowing, untroubled by anything that's there, a sound, a pain, a thought, whoosh. Then there can be this growing intuition that this mind-ing, this mind process, including awareness in it, the whole thing, the whole kit and caboodle of our experience, arises dependently upon vast processes, a lot of which have to do with the material universe, rippling through us to make this moment of mind. Conditioned as well by this whole history that has shaped the nervous system, that has set it up so that, you know, pressure on the thigh feels like that, or, you know, a sound sounds like that, right? It's just vast networks of causes, this moment of experiencing, this moment of mind, right here, wherever it is arising based on. So therefore, what's happening in mind gives us a very direct intuition of reality altogether. Not in a cosmic sense, just in a very real sense. What's happening in mind right now, hearing, seeing, tasting, thinking, etc., is based on this vast web of nature, of physical processes. So you open into that oneness as well. You start having an intuition that allness is rippling through you, making this moment of experience. I think that's what those people are doing. They're stable there. You know, we cultivate it in our practice to stabilize it. And then as we go through our days, increasingly there's less and less differentiation or distinction between the meditative state and just the ordinary state. A very senior American monk, Ajahn Sumedho, was asked a while ago, what do you do when you meditate? Right? It's reverse engineering. We're trying to understand what is someone who's really far along, done a lot of practice, what's going on? He said, I no longer distinguish between the meditative state and the ordinary state. Not because his meditative state sucked, but it's all just experience. You know, it's all about relationship to experience and kind of insight into experience. Okay, so far we're in this. So now we have these two. We're done. First, you know, oneness, allness of experience, and then using that as an intuition, which often will last only for just a short period of time, and then you're thinking about it. But that intuition grows, that you're just being rippled by reality. That's like really far out. You know, and you get it. You get it. It's like a wow. And then your mind goes back to trying to think about it. And then, okay. But the next time you get a little more powerfully, and those gets start extending, and they start kind of, I don't know, infusing even neurotic mind with some of their qualities. And then last, just to finish, the third level is one that the Buddha talked about. Certainly people in theistic traditions talk about it, you know, where, so I'll say it like this. What starts to happen is more and more, including in meditation, you realize that what's there, this sound, this thought, etc., it's always changing, you know. But its nature does not change. The nature of experience, the nature of mind matter, mind materiality, nama rupa in Hindu, you know, the nature, isn't that wild? The nature doesn't change. And what you can do more and more is you can abide as the nature of experience. Like you get it, it disappears, you get it again. The nature of things. And you realize that you always are just the nature of things. Which I think of as Buddha nature. You are just the nature of things. That nature of things is always true, even if we don't recognize it. And I think what these people do, and I'm oodling my way in that direction, is they're just hanging increasingly as the nature of things, untroubled by the things themselves. See, you can explore that. It's really hard to talk about it, but more and more you can just kind of get like, okay, mind has all these things happening in it, but what's the nature of mind? You know, or the nature of reality altogether. It's compounded, it's made up of parts, it comes and goes, and yet its nature remains. Its nature is stable. You know, what is still? Where is the stillness? And you start to intuit a kind of fundamental tranquility or stillness in the nature of experience and the nature of matter. And then you feel, it like feels super free. Like, thank you. And then if it's real, that's where I was going, as the Buddha talked about and other people in theistic traditions talk about, in that nature of things, for many people, there is a sense of something transcendental woven into the underlying nature of things, underlying nature of mind and matter that makes mind. Buddha talked about it as the deathless, the unconditioned. Unconditionality is another way to put it, because unconditioned sounds like a noun, you know, a thing, a void, a space. You know, he says basically there is that which does not change. There is that which knows not birth nor death. You know, in that my mind delights. That's what we're talking about, like cultivating that and, you know, delighting in that increasingly. And for some people, you know, me included probably, there's a sense of in that which my mind delights has qualities of consciousness and benevolence. You know, even a kind of bliss woven into it. And if it's true for someone, not conceptualizing about it, but as a journey, as an inquiry, you know, we can do this in our own practice. Why not? Why not open to and allow and invite, you know, as much as we can, this authentic to us, you know, that to which we aspire, including in this fourth aspect, deep end of the pool, that sense of oneness, you know, which includes, in my experience, allowing oneself to be increasingly the nature of things, distinct from things themselves. Okay. What in the world? So anyway, that's my best shot. What do you think? How's it for you? Yeah.
Sounds hard.
Sounds hard? Well, the good news, sounds hard, he says. And it's interesting because this, you're talking about the last part here, of course, right? The first two parts? Probably, yeah. Yeah. And I don't experience it as hard, and I think it's progressive. I think gradually, you just see for yourself, but minimally, you can recognize that there's only, the mind is a whole. Right? We have partitions in it, like there's that sight there and there's that sound there, but those are just aspects of mind. It's like there's the cloth as a whole, right? Sure, we could point to different patterns on it or different colors of thread or, you know, this is where the, you know, I don't know, the kid dropped something on it, but it's just the whole, mind as a whole. You know, I was thinking of entry into this topic, and there's a Zen story, you may know it. Two monks, actually a famous Zen story. There are two monks, and they're arguing, and there's a flag, and it's moving. So one monk says, "See, the flag is moving." The second monk says, "No, it's the wind that's moving." And the third monk, senior monk, walks by and says, "Nope. It's your mind that's moving." Yeah. And one last little thing too, you know, I mean, I think it's great to talk about really down to earth stuff. Like, how do we deal with getting a brain tumor? Hello, right? Or emotional issues interpersonally, but I just really feel that it's appropriate, certainly occasionally, just to talk about, you know, the possibility of, you know, cultivating here more and more of the qualities of whatever we aspire to and not setting our sights too low. Anybody else? Comment or question? Great, yeah.
Yeah, so I noticed there's an explosion of books on mindfulness at work, and you spoken of the site, NASA. Why do you think that is?
Why are there books about mindfulness at work?
Mindfulness at work.
Oh. Well, for one, it's interesting to think about it. We spend more time at work, most people, than we spend with our most intimate, beloved partner. So if you're going to make a difference in somebody's life, you know, one major theater or domain to make it in is work. And I think also because for a lot of people, work's pretty stressful. And it tends to be very hijacking of attention, right? And to go back to my thing here from what you're saying, you know, as you develop more of a kind of stability as mind as a whole, you're less hijackable by the parts of mind that come. More and more rapidly you come home to hanging as the mind as a whole. And you pull out of getting all uptight about, you know, what that person said, you know, more and more, because you realize, wow, the only thing happening really is mind, you know, arising dependently upon matter in this vast network. Thank you. Yeah.
I guess the word resilience, this is a tool of resilience that kept coming up for me. And again, I'm trying to be real, I'm just pragmatic. I'm sorry, I gave up on trying to get enlightened years ago. So for me, it's just like handling the stress of the demands of stuff going on out there. And
yeah.
Especially, you know, with our election and all that. You know, in my mind, like a lot of people, is cogitating about all that and consequences, and, you know, the all stuff. That we, how to be with that. I used to think that this was about, I might cultivate some passivity and then I won't care about the real world and being politically active, et cetera, and God help me on that. But now I'm realizing it's really about if I can go to that equilibrium in the midst of the overloads that I have in my life, at least it will help my nervous system.
Yeah. That's great. You know, to stress the point too of different kinds of meditation, right? And if we are saying to ourselves, you know, why not? You know, a classic injunction to people, the Buddha would start off in what his talks, he would say, oh, nobly born. It's a presumption of a kind of nobility or an ennoblingness in people. Or another common phrase is, oh, sons and daughters of the Buddha, right? Or people talk about meditation instructions, you know, sit like a king or queen on your throne, not all uptight, but with a certain dignity or enactment or embodiment of that to which you aspire, including, you know, qualities of loving kindness and radiance and sustained presence and freedom. What are those qualities, you know, in human beings that we aspire to, right? And then to what extent is it available to us to encourage them and protect them or open to them with sincerity in our heart as we sit, as we meditate, or as we do anything else? You know, it's variations on that can become almost silly, but they're profound in their heart. What would Jesus do? What would the Buddha do? You know, what would Mother Teresa do? What would Gandhi do, right? Pick your person. What would St. Francis do? And then we increasingly embody that. And since neurons fire together, they wire together, you know, we weave those qualities increasingly and we give ourselves over increasingly, you know, to those good qualities we aspire to. And they're authentic, because we feel them in the moment we feel them. Maybe that moment lasts only a third of a second, but in that moment, those neurons are firing in that way, right? And then over time, we stabilize those moments increasingly. Great, last person, then I'll wrap up.
So there are these three forms of meditation. How do they manifest in a given session or over time? I mean, during the course of session?
Yeah.
I mean, are you engaging in all three of them? Are you focusing on
personally,
one?
Yeah.
Over time,
uh-huh.
Do you like,
right.
Want to do one particular kind of meditation for
yeah.
2 months? Or how do you think of that?
I think that's a great question. So how, wrapping up on this one then, how do we think about these three kinds of meditation? There may well be others, I think, you know. First of all, I think the most important kind of meditation to do is the one you'll do. So, and I'm trying to be willing to talk about the range here. Like, I don't know how more profoundly to meditate than to open into and be God, in a sense. And I'm happy to talk about that in a more secular frame. You know, it's hard to imagine what would be more profound than opening out into a being unconditionality, you know, infused with love, right? Like, whoa. But over here, man, you got your knickers in a twist, you're bothered by something, you know, and you sit down and you chill out and you get up 10 minutes later, let's say, let alone 45, and your head's clear. You know, it shook out. It's like the snow globe. You know, someone gave me a Buddha inside a snow globe for a present. It's really great. Isn't that how the mind is a lot? You come in, it's like, woo, all those snakes are twirling. And the best we can do is just kind of let them settle. And that's absolutely worthy, totally respectable, really appropriate. And as they settle, what also settles out, craving and clinging starts falling away. Taking things personally starts falling away. A natural warm-heartedness starts shining through more and more. And we experience more, we're less caught up in the parts of mind and we're more abiding as mind as a whole. Aha! Those four qualities I named are the mind of a Buddha found as we let the snow globe of the mind just kind of calm down. So I think that's a very important one, a very, very important one. It helps to strengthen concentration. That's the second kind of meditation where you pick an object of attention like the sensations of breathing and you just say, hey, for 5 minutes or 45 minutes, let's say, I'm just going to give myself over to that one object of attention and seek to become increasingly absorbed in it. You know, great. You know, I think we bounce around. It's okay to bounce around. I bounce around. You know, I roll in here. I do the snow globe meditation in the very beginning, you know, landing here, nice people, home, you know, I'm at this point, my mind's pretty stable, so I have that part. Sometimes I'll really go after just amazing, like the granularity of experience, how fast it changes. But honestly, for me, a lot, my own practice is really about, you know, like opening out into allness as best I can. Relaxing, and it's like, you know, being increasingly accessible to, like, the really amazingness of it, of what's possible. And without exalting yourself, that's what's really important, too. You know, because you realize, again, paradoxically, the more transparency there is to those big waves, you know, the more you're the ocean, as it were. It's like there's less and less to like get conceited about it, whatever. You know, I'll finish on this line, you know, from a Southeast Asian teacher, I think. He said, love yourself. Just don't love yourself. On that note, let's sit for a minute. if you'll put up with me for about 30 more seconds, mm-hmm. that thing at the very end there, you know, what I'm trying to say is, to your point about it seeming hard, the good news here is that the nature of everything already is wonderful. And that's your nature, right? That's my nature. That's our nature. I think that's like, and again, what do these people say? These sages, these saints, they basically say, wow, I discovered the most wonderful thing that was under my nose all along. They don't talk about being transported. They talk about being revealed here and now. Like, that's good news. Like, the good news of being the nature of things and the nature of the nature of things. Anyway. All right. Good night.
In consideration of your need to go home, I can collect the Donna and I'll send it for you and just bring
you're
it to you next.
Thank you.
Yeah, so be well. Love you.
I love you too. Great. Oh, 1 second. Let me turn off the recording. Otherwise, you will be immortalized.